Walt changed his timing sheets. The jokes became hammier, the reactions more crowd-pleasing. Same drawings, different cartoon. Walt was allowed to do this. As the boss, he had final cut. But he had never crossed that line with Ub before. No animator ever crossed that line. When Ub found out, he was incensed at his partner's lack of respect. "Don't you ever touch my drawings," he exploded in rare anger. "These are my drawings, and this is how I solve the problem. Keep your hands off them." Micromanaging was one thing, but sabotage was another. Walt backed down. What you see in The Skeleton Dance is Ub's timing sheet, not Walt's. For a year, Walt had sold Ub up and down the streets of New York as the world's greatest animator. It worked. Ub was getting acclaim from outside the industry. International magazines like Povu called him the man who created Mickey. But inside the studio, and perhaps inside his heart, Walt's relationship with Ub changed. His partner of 10 years was now no different than any other talent. Disney was not a place to find artistic fulfillment as an artist. It was where Walt found his fulfillment. Everyone else was the hired help. Chapter 14. Hat Tip. If you had to pick a food to represent Walt Disney, it'd be hot dogs. Hot dogs are cheap, convenient, and lowbrow. They're associated with baseball and barbecues and that most American of sauces, ketchup. Many of Walt's early gags involve wieners or wiener dogs. The name hot dog itself is a joke, about assuming the worst regarding what's inside the sausage casing. When the British royal family visited America for the first time, President Franklin Roosevelt served them hot dogs. Mickey opens the Carnival Kid by serving up some all-American Frankfurters. In the middle of a packed Carnival Midway, Mickey has his Franks perform tricks. He makes them sing by bopping them like piano keys, a gag that has been tributed on both The Muppets and Monty Python's Flying Circus. One dog gets spanked, another gets a mustard bath. "Hot dogs, hot dogs," Mickey calls out. Just as the New York premiere of Steamboat Willie is considered Mickey's birthday, these are considered Mickey's first words. Hot dog. The theme song to an updated Mickey Mouse Clubhouse cartoon show is built around those words. Mickey and company do the hot dog dance over the refrain, "Hot dog, hot dog, hot diggity dog, it's the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse." But a full minute before he hawks meat tubes, Mickey warns customers about Pete the Barker the next booth over. Pete has been claiming that Minnie will put you in a trance with her hoochie-coochie dance. Pete then makes a Minnie puppet dance seductively. Mickey warns the crowd against Pete's lasciviousness, using his first official words. Those words? "It's a bumhole stand. Keep your money in your pants." The bumhole refers to Pete's carnival stand, not Pete. Talkies were still so new that this was many moviegoers' first overheard conversation. It may have been a shock that Mickey could talk at all. He was an animal, after all. Not talking was part of what defines them. Dialogue would humanize tunes to a new degree. And that voice. Walt had used a squeaky screech for Mickey. How could any character with such a falsetto ever be taken seriously? Ub's lip-syncing is first-rate. Amazing, considering he'd never done it before. Lip-syncing would become a bête noir for animation, since it's time-consuming and only noticed when done wrong. Frugal studios animate first, then hire voice actors. First-rate crews record first. For The Carnival Kid, Ub drew first. Walt had to sync his dialogue with Mickey's existing lip flaps. Walt wasn't satisfied with his falsetto for Mickey. A falsetto is by definition strained, and it makes for a difficult emotional range. Walt smoked, and he wasn't a trained performer. Ebullience can take you only so far. He decided to hire a professional to do Mickey's voice. Loads of people were better than him at animating. surely someone could sound like they just landed hard on a bicycle seat. Over the next few Mickey installments, a rotisserie league of voices tried out for the role of Mickey. Walt coached each of them, including giving them line readings. Line readings are usually a big no-no to actors, but these readings convinced everyone at Disney who was the walking, talking spirit of Mickey Mouse. Walt was the last to know in the audition process he talked himself into the job. Soon he'd be joking that he cast himself because he was already salaried. One throwaway gag in The Carnival Kid would generate a defining aspect of Disneyana. When Mickey first meets Minnie, he gentlemanly doffs his hat. But he's not wearing a hat, so he doffs his ears. Oswald did the exact same thing. It's hard to find anything new in a 1929 Mickey Mouse cartoon, but the joke worked better with round ears. Decades later, producers of a daily TV show were looking for a special type of hat that all its teen stars could wear. Disney had recently hit pay dirt with Davy Crockett hats, causing the first raccoon fur shortage in about 200 years. Hats were in. One of the show's hosts, a former animator, remembered the Mickey hat gig. A twist of wire here, a swath of black felt there, and voila, the Mickey Mouse club ears. Having to create a new cartoon every few weeks was daunting. Inspiration doesn't always strike on a timetable, as Walt was finding out. One tried-and-true way of finding new material is autobiography, mining your navel. Everything from radio serials to comic strip artists to vaudevillians incorporated their personal lives into their act. Viewing Disney's output as a diary, then, what does it say about his world? He included a lot of the pizzazz that led to the 1920s being called the era of wonderful nonsense, dancing, romancing, and fast cars. Mickey visits a carnival, a steamboat, and the Argentinian plains. Oswald and Alice also visited the Old West, the Canadian plains, and the railroad yards. It's understandable that current events don't get a mention. You try making a funny animal cartoon about Sacco and Vanzetti. It also makes business sense. Mickey was bipartisan, both for Coolidge Democrats and Hoover Republicans. He stayed away from flash-in-the-pan 1920s fads, such as dance marathons or crosswords. They might date the cartoon. This lack of specificity also helped the global audience, who didn't want 7 minutes of references only an American would understand. Mickey also avoided sports, despite his animators being a bunch of jocks who played volleyball during lunch and mounted married versus single baseball games in the lot across the street. Ub played too. He excelled at horseshoes. The only thing Walt mined for inspiration was movies. The Gorilla Mystery, for instance, was based on the exploitation film Ngagi. Mickey in Arabia would not exist without Rudolph Valentino's Amorous Sheik, nor the Klondike Kid without Chaplin's The Gold Rush. Westerns, firefighting, jailbreak, you name the subgenre, Mickey would soon be there. Every adventure was a virtual crossover into another hit film. A decade before Abbott and Costello met monsters, Mickey walked the same line between parody and pastiche. Mickey reflects not Walt's life, but the films Walt saw. That was his muse. Not his family and friends, not the world and its conflicts. Just the movies. Without movies, Mickey Mouse is nothing. With them, though, he's Doug Fairbanks, Harold Lloyd, the Little Tramp, and the Sheik. Was this Walt's view as well, that without a life in the pictures, he had nothing? Mickey was the first second-generation movie star. He was a hodgepodge of every big star's best qualities. To celebrate him is to celebrate all those he celebrates. He's a montage of classic moments, a greatest hits package of motives and actions. He's a bit of a hot dog that way. Chapter 15. Yoo-hoo! Short, squat, and tough as nails, Mickey gave a beating to anyone in Los Angeles who stood in his way. It was 1929 when the world first got to know him and his clean living but dirty as sin ways. Within a decade, he would be rubbing shoulders with the biggest names in the world of crime. This was not Mickey Mouse. This was Mickey Cohen, the gangster who would run Los Angeles in the 1940s. He began in 1929 as a boxer, facing guys his own size, before graduating to mob enforcer and taking over the organized crime in the entire Southland. The parallels go beyond the name. Both invented stories of their rise to power. Both were formed from their years in Middle America, and both were out of power before the 1940s were through. Mickey Cohen ended his days in Alcatraz, though. Mickey Mouse was destined for more. The Mouse's next short was Mickey's Follies, an ensemble comedy in the vein of The Barn Dance and The Opry House. One little problem. Mickey did not have an ensemble. So Walt and Ub tried to whip up a stable of barnyard friends for him. It didn't work. Any cutaway from Mickey falls flat. The supporting cast has no personality outside the gags. What Mickey's Follies would be remembered for was Carl Stalling's next step in musical animation. It was the culmination of Carl's songwriting, Walt's desire to keep Mickey Mouse on the spearhead of sound, and Ub's ability to match sound cues with visual movements. Mickey had talked, but now he was going to sing. A duck holds up a sign saying, Mickey's Theme Song. Mickey plays the opening piano chords, then moves out of the way so the stool can take over on the 88 keys. Mickey jumps on the lid, and his white glove starts snapping. To quote Al Jolson, you ain't heard nothing yet. I'm the guy they call Little Mickey Mouse, he sings. Got a sweetie down in the chicken house. Mickey's hands and face are amazingly alive, more expressive than an American Idol contestant. To keep Mickey both in tune and tempo, Carl is probably the one supplying Mickey's singing voice. In one unbroken shot, and probably one unbroken vocal take, Mickey sings the entire song. The 66-second song's an excuse for Mickey to sing like barnyard animals. Minnie interrupts from her box seat to sing the song's last word, which is, "Yoo-hoo." Then she suggestively snaps some gum. Minnie here is voiced by Marjorie Ralston, an ink girl. She'd be replaced by another ink girl, Marcelite Garner, who would sing in Spanish for The Cactus Kid. Mickey ends the song by playing the drums on various parts of himself, noodling on the sax and trombone, and dancing until he crashes through the piano lid. The song's title, Minnie's Yoo-Hoo, is as suggestive as anything that blues singer Ma Rainey ever put to Wax Cylinder. It was an impressive debut from new director Jack Zahn, who would go on to produce more minutes of Disney animation than maybe anyone other than Walt. Mickey Mouse had a single. The following year, Disney released Sheet Music and a special sing-along version of Minnie's Yoo-Hoo to theaters. After a few seconds of playful Mickey, an offstage baritone leads the matinee crowd in a two-verse sing-along. The extra-large Yoo-Hoo shown on screen, with its squashed, flattened serifs and askew O's, looks remarkably like the Yahoo logo. For the refrain, Mickey pops his head out, revealing that he was the deep voice. The song became two hits for the price of one. The short served as a commercial for the sheet music, which in turn reminded people to go see the latest Mickey Mouse film. As the saying went, ads were to business what fertilizer is to a farm. Surely not the last time someone would use manure to describe an advertisement. Disney had hits in two worlds, film and music. Mickey's Follies led to releasing the recordings from various Silly Symphonies sans animation as songs. That led to Disneyland Records, which over the years has given the world the double platinum Mickey Mouse Disco Mousercise, so popular it spawned a daily TV show, and Totally Minnie, which included a duet with Elton John, not to mention a few hundred soundtracks. More profitable than the one song, or Disney's entire 90-year musical endeavor, is Minnie Mouse herself. For five generations, girls around the world have been drawn to Minnie for one simple reason. She's a girl. Add a dress, a hat, fancy shoes, a purse, all the items three-year-olds wear to look like mommy. Kids look for a special connection with everything, and many looks and acts just like they do when they play grown-up. Until very recently, Minnie has not been allowed to do much more than be the damsel, the flirt, the occasional scold. She was even more limited than Mickey, the wife of the mayor of Dullesville. Audiences seem to prefer a pair of homebodies, though. Minnie remains as conceptually pure as Mickey, a perfect match in backstory-deficient heaven. A less challenging cartoon than Mickey's Follies was in the works at the time, a bullfighting silly symphony called El Terrible Toreador. The Disney A-Team was working on Follies, so the bullfighting short was designed without too many technical challenges. One character looks very familiar. Tall, thin mustache, floppy hair, eyes ablaze with passion. Hey, it's Walt! The animators decided to cast their boss as the Matador, despite Walt already having a rather famous animated alter ego. Walt would get another doppelganger with Mortimer Mouse, the title character in 1936's Mickey's Rival. Since paying work on Mickey came first, it had taken about 6 months to complete the skeleton dance. Now that the symphonies were sold, though, they could be cranked out like Model Ts. Ub's attention was undoubtedly with Mickey's Follies during production, but the truncated deadlines don't show in either Toreador's animation or its design. Even the human characters, always a trouble for animators, look good. Where the stress fractures are most evident are in the story. The plot features a guy, a girl, and a foe. This is what Walt used for numerous Oswalds, as well as the Galloping Gaucho, the Barn Dance, and the Carnival Kid. As the symphonies progress, the settings will change. The world of birds or bugs or a fairy tale land. But the story never changes. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. Mickey was supposed to be the one who stayed the same, hence his parallax ears. The sillies were where you'd see variety. That was the sweet and salty mix audiences were promised. Walt's trouble with Mickey was spilling over to the sillies. The symphony was the same song, over and over. That familiar story was Walt's own success story. He was the earnest and humble hero. His company was the damsel in distress, and the harsh outside world played the villain, threatening to take his girl away. Take note that there's always a fourth character in this story, the army. Each hero rallies an army to defeat the villain. This was Walt's subconscious in action. Each short would take viewers on the same emotional journey, a secular ritual. Walt the moviegoer knew what audiences found truly satisfying, what people longed for. The lonely heart will find love, the cowboy will save the day, and the snob will get his comeuppance. As if using a model sheet of plots, Walt spun the same tale over and over, codifying each happy ending. It was unintentional. Walt was simply out of gas. Mickey was a promise of something new, but people would get used to him, then tired of him, and he would recede as thoroughly as all the stars of yesterday. If Walt didn't let others take the reins, his writer's block could doom the whole company. No one knew that as well as Ub Iwerks. Ub had sublimated his ego on Walt's behalf, and so had everyone else. Yet Disney's dictator wasn't letting anyone help him. Worse, Walt wouldn't admit anything was wrong. He had the gall to write to Powers asking to double the number of Mickeys per month. Powers turned him down. The soup was thin enough. There had to be some other way Disney could gin up some quick cash, though. Walt started pitching sound newsreels. Will Rogers doing stand-up comedy, or Al Jolson and Joan Crawford attending a gala premiere. Powers turned those down as well. All he wanted from Walt was the mouse. 1929 was also when Edwin Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe. Stars are always moving away from each other. So too were the creators of stars. Walt and Ub were fast approaching the last cartoon they would ever make together. Chapter 16. Locomotion. For 2,000 years, Sunday was the day of rest. But the definition of rest was changing. What used to be a day for community service and church programs was now devoted to leisure and entertainment, games, carnivals, and movies. Sunday was the biggest day of the week for film, and whoever didn't get their ticket would be out of the loop for that week's chin-wagging. This was why some church groups were trying to close the theaters on Sunday. How could a local preacher compete with Claudette Colbert and Lillian Gish? Sunday was when the week's dosage of morality and ethics were implanted. What were the folks on their backsides, instead of their knees, filling their heads with? One mother, quoted in 1929's anthropology study, Middletown, was direct. I send my daughter to the theater because a girl has to learn the ways of the world somehow, and the movies are a good safe place. Studies showed that even back then, moviegoer kids knew that what they saw was not real life. But the stories we tell ourselves matter. People are more glamorous, heroes more true, and villains more base. Let's see what Mickey teaches us. Mickey's choo-choo begins with a downright malevolent-looking train. Evil personified, steam and smoke pouring from its engine egress. The train is supposed to look exhausted, not demonic, but the slightest warp in the ovals of its ocular headlights, the slightest waver to the wince of its cowcatcher teeth, brought a whole different interpretation to the drawings. Ub was off by a few millimeters, and the horrific result almost ruined the rest of the short. The hell train is shown gingerly huffing its way backwards on the train equivalent of tiptoes. Engineer Mickey arrives to buckle it into a cold tender before the train collapses in a defeated heap. Mickey starts singing, I've been working on the railroad. Then it's lunchtime. Mickey feeds the train shovelfuls of coal like kibble. Mickey opens a can of spaghetti and shares it with a helpful dog. Enter Minnie, carrying her fiddle and whistling. She and Mickey talk in their first dialogue scene. Frankly, it's boring. But to see such an underwhelming exchange in an animated film is breathtaking. To modern ears, this is the best part of the cartoon, as if we caught Mickey and Minnie shoegazing at craft services between takes. Walt could have made Mickey a yuck machine the way he was in print, but he chose an aw-shucks bashfulness instead. What Mickey and Minnie were saying were sweet nothings. The actual words didn't matter. Hearing them banter felt transgressional, like eavesdropping on someone in the powder room. Minnie starts bowing her fiddle while Mickey plays railroad ties like a xylophone. Disney relied on the xylophone more than authors of alphabet books. To pad out the runtime, Mickey starts his barnyard animals as instruments business. Ducks become horns. A dog becomes an upright bass. This goes on for minutes. We eventually cut back to the train whose weight makes a bridge droop. Mickey tries pushing the train up a hill, which dislodges the caboose. This sends Minnie rocketing into a first-person stunt ride through tunnels and back over the bridge. The caboose crashes through a cart full of ducks. When a cow wanders into the path of the caboose, a second forced perspective shot begins. Cow and car end up crashing into a tree, and the falling debris creates a fortuitous pump car. Mickey and Minnie end the short riding off into a train tunnel. Kids, ask your parents. As with a fast food menu, Mickey's habitus is a few components endlessly rearranged. Musical animals, a chase scene, Minnie in trouble, and so forth. The train was a great new addition, but Walt does next to nothing with it. He could retell War and Peace, and it'd be 7 minutes long with four of them dancing animals. Walt's retirement from animating improved Disney as a company. With his nose not grindstone adjacent, he had more time to enhance A-list gags. That gave Ub more reason to put his best effort into each shot. Stepping away from directing was also a net gain. Walt could serve as a champion for whatever wasn't getting enough attention. Yet he couldn't walk away from writing. In lieu of actual ideas, Walt began brainstorming new gimmicks. What about color? Color photography had been around for decades. The Great Train Robbery in 1904 was colorized via hand-painted patches of tint. Colored stock was routinely used to enhance the illusion of a scene. Blue for night, yellow for desert, red for fire. Most Mickeys had been shown not in black and white, but a tinted monochrome. Plain Crazy was probably blue for the sky, and the Galloping Gaucho yellow for the desert. Steamboat Willie made Mickey a hit because of sound. Imagine how big he could be in color. Was there a shortcut to convert a strip of black and white film into color? The short answer is no. And even if there was, Mickey was as black and white as a zebra. The only thing about him that could be colored was his shorts. You might as well write a musical about a mute. Mickey was tied to black and white. In September 1929, as Mickey's Choo Choo was huffing and puffing its way to theaters, a local theater manager named Harry W. Wooden approached Walt with a proposition. Wooden ran Santa Monica's Fox Dome Theater up in Ocean Park, and he wanted to start a club for kids. You know, with pie-eating contests and marble tournaments and all that. Except this club would revolve around the character the American magazine called the world's only unpaid movie star. America was a nation of club joiners. Churches desperate for members started clubs. Charities and civic groups devolved into clubs. The overscheduled masses joked they were being clubbed to death. But movies were still single-ticket affairs. Here was a way to turn a solitary experience into a communal one. Instead of a solo, a mass. Walt was smart enough to not turn down free publicity, so he said yes. Wooden quickly put out a press release boasting that Walt, UB Iwerk, and Carl Stalling would be at the Friday matinee to explain how cartoons were made and to introduce Mickey. Walt was smart enough to hire Wooden to set up his Mickey Mouse clubs across the country. What worked in Ocean Park could work nationwide, even without in-person appearances. No one minded that this club was aimed at children, an audience biologically incapable of resisting a film flim-flam. Children were still being used for labor in the 1920s. A national movie club was no little endeavor. As the writer Bill Bryson pointed out in One Summer, 1/6 of all Americans were at the movies every single day, purchasing 100 million tickets every week. Film was the nation's fourth largest business, bringing in $750 million a year. And there were few national anythings. The first coast-to-coast radio ad had only come in 1928. If the Mickey Mouse Club worked, it might be the only shared experience an Arkansas kid would have with her Chicago relatives. Movie theater promotions were key to spreading the word about a film. Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera, for instance, had 17 different posters in 3 different sizes. Also common were trailers, shown after the feature, hence their caboose-ish name. Lobby cards and single-frame interstitial ads between films. These promotions boosted ticket sales, so theater owners played along. Promotions for Mickey Mouse started out humble enough. One 1929 Mickey poster contained a blank space to write in the name of the latest short. Walt told friends and family to fake a grassroots campaign of asking theaters to book Mickey. But the Mickey Mouse Club would revolutionize the concept of a public relations campaign. Wooden used a two-pronged attack on theater owners. First, the local film distributors passed on information about how to run a Mickey Mouse Club. There was a lot of work. A newsletter to distribute, chants to lead, play money to distribute, merchandise to stock, buttons to wear. Store owners around town needed to offer discounts for Mickey Mouse Club members. Stores that played ball got to post orange official Mickey Mouse store signs. Disney was basically asking each theater to donate hours of its time each week, promoting a short. The second prong of the attack was via press releases announcing the Mickey Mouse clubs. That got moviegoers asking for the clubs. Any theater not showing Mickey shorts, or showing them but not offering the club, started to hear about it. Capitulating was easier than fighting a crowd. It wasn't just peer pressure to join the club, it was peer pressure to start one. The club made going to the movies a social event. There would be official bulletins filled with jokey write-ups of the famous mouse. Kids would sing along to Minnie's Yoo-Hoo. Another ditty went like this. Happy kids are we, eeny, icky, minny, mickey, M-O-U-S-E. In a year's time, the club was international, with 375 licensed clubs, and who knows how many unlicensed hangers-on as well. In 2 years' time, it had 1 million members. By 1932, it was larger than the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts combined. To borrow a new word from the energy industry, Mickey Mouse was a superpower. Like a grifter who kept building to bigger scams, the club's official bulletin was a place to hawk Mickey Mouse merchandise. Masks, birthday cards, pens, rulers, t-shirts, balloons, the Mickey Mouse book. All this merchandise was sold to theater owners in bulk, who vended them to moviegoers. New Mickey decor showed up regularly, described as box office aids. Most theaters profited from their sales. There were also giveaways, often branded with ads for other Mickey products. Local drugstores even started to sponsor the clubs. Advertisements supported advertisements. This seems a good place to note that a 1920 synonym for ads was exploitation. The Mickey Mouse book, which was not made by Disney, featured the first ever origin story for Mickey. Mickey was originally called Mouse 13 and was kicked out of Mouse Fairyland for pulling too many pranks. When he was expelled, he fell down Walt Disney's chimney, and Walt put him to work. Mickey chose his name because he loved green cheese, and green's an Irish color. The success of the Mickey Mouse Club was quickly copied by other film serials. If you got your bat card from the 1943 Batman serial punched regularly, for instance, you could watch the final installment for free. Attend weekly dish night viewings, and you got a table setting. But most serials were cheapo affairs. Only Disney spent so much to maintain a fan base. Only Disney saw its star become entrenched in the American way of life. Chapter 17. Paper Doll. Celebrities look better than us. Even teeth, golden skin, no belly, full head of hair. Cartoons were no exception. Mickey can come off as a plastic surgery addict due to his alterations. His features move. He's thick, then he's thin. His ears move around. And his eyes, big, small, beady, blinking, they were in continual flux. The newest change in The Jazz Fool was to give Mickey irises with white triangular knockouts, resembling a silhouette of Pac-Man. Those eyes date The Jazz Fool to the 1920s as definitely as horse-drawn hansom cabs evoke Victorian England. The Jazz Fool begins with Mickey on a wagon labeled Mickey's Big Roadshow, being pulled by a new character, Horace Horsecollar. Horace is playing a calliope, and a stockyard of dancing animals follows behind. They all move in perfect rhythm to the song, even hovering mid-jump when Mickey holds a note. They are clockwork automatons running off the same drivetrain. This lockstep would gain the nickname Mickey Mousing. After some dancing laundry antics, Mickey and Horace set up their music show. What follows are old xylophone gags, new xylophone gags, old piano gags, and new piano gags. Walt had strung together yet another Mickey short from Oddments, the Opry House's piano recital, Mickey's Follies Dancing Animals, the Plowboy's Equine Antics. Cribbing your own work from 3 months earlier doesn't count as a tribute or a running gag, just a lack of inspiration. There was originality to be had in the Silly Symphonies, though. Springtime, released around the time of The Jazz Fool, showcased the circle of life antics of nature, including a bird devouring the early worm and hatchlings not yet covered in feathers. A tree takes a shower in the rain, and grasshoppers use mushroom caps as umbrellas. A frog finds himself on both sides of the food chain, eating a bug and then hopping away from a crane. The music goes from Edvard Grieg's Morning to Amilcare Ponchielli's Dance of the Hours, later parodied as Hello Mudda, Hello Fada by Alan Sherman. Springtime was designed to be the first of four seasonal features, mixing nature gags with bucolic music. That was nothing compared to the other symphony released in November, Hell's Bells, which seemed designed to double the spooky appeal and outrage of The Skeleton Dance. Instead of a mere graveyard, Hell's Bells takes place in H.E. Double Hockey Sticks itself. The opening bursts into flames, then subsides as a ghoul slinks around a fiery pit. An evil spider swings at the screen. Bob's spiders are always six-legged, just as his gloves are four-fingered, and is burnt by a fire creature. Giant lizards, dragons, bats, imps, and even Cerberus, each of its three heads a different breed of dog, are all there. When Satan himself arrives, he's tapping his feet to Charles Gounod's macabre Funeral March of a Marionette, later the theme to Alfred Hitchcock's Presents. It's not Faust, but it's far darker than one of Mickey's Barnyard shows. Both of these silly symphonies were directed not by Walt, but by Ub. He had been considered weak at story, and hadn't directed before. But the way Walt was whiffing, someone had to step up. The Jazz Fool is forgettable in seconds, while Springtime and Hell's Bells stay with the viewer. Which one of them was supposed to be the idea man again? Which one of them had their name on the building? Carolyn Charlotte Clark, a Los Angeles local, Charlie Chaplin lived down the block, had contacted Walt Disney Studios about a job. She was a seamstress and she wanted to make a Mickey doll. Would that be okay? Mickey Mouse's likeness on a collectible? Mickey Mouse merchandising was new. During a New York trip in November 1929, Walt received $300 from a stationery company to add Mickey to some school pads. It was printed with a spot color. Mickey's shoes and shorts were the same rich red as his history book and an apple. Copyright 1930, Walter E. Disney is written underneath. He was very formal to the copyright office. $300 was nothing to sneeze at, but the dolls had the potential for even more. I should think, Walt wrote to Pat Powers, that there would be a big market for Mickey dolls, toys, and novelties for the coming season, and it may not be a bad idea to feel out the possibilities along these lines, and these things are also considered very good publicity. Powers disagreed. No Mickey dolls. Even after Walt offered 10% of the profits, Powers still said no. He was probably trying to rein in Walt, but in this case, it would cost him dearly. Roy gave the doll project his blessing, so Charlotte began to create Mickey in three dimensions. Some of the choices she made are with us today. Mickey's shorts were gray on screen, for instance, but Charlotte chose red shorts with yellow buttons and yellow shoes to match. Those remain Mickey's colors. She also gave Mickey fawn-colored gloves, which didn't catch on as well. For Mickey's all-important ears, she mixed geometric simplicity with actual rodent anatomy. She tucked in the bottoms of a triangular piece of black cloth and sewed the folds into Mickey's head. This created both a circular shape and the natural curve of a mouse's ears. Later, ears were plain cloth circles. She also used pie-cut eyes instead of solid black irises. Those peepers appeared in only one early Mickey cartoon, but Charlotte's decision cemented them as part of Mickey. Charlotte Clark enlisted the help of her nephew Bob, who lived next door. Bob earned 30 cents for each Mickey he stuffed, and helped draw the patterns. He even helped push-start Walt's car when Walt stopped by to pick up some dolls. Walt wanted to hire the boy himself, but there wasn't room in the office for another body. Too bad. Bob would grow up to be Bob Clampett, a founding father of Looney Tunes. The dolls caught on quickly. Soon Charlotte could not produce enough dolls to meet demand. Roy rented a house to be her factory, but it was not a question of floor space. No single person could supply all of Los Angeles, and Walt wanted to go nationwide. The solution was to branch out again into a new sub-licensing venture. Disney already sold the dolls, which went for a pricey $5 each at stores like Bullock's and the May Company. Now they would sell the patterns, too, for an affordable 35 cents. Any family with a needle and thread could add Mickey Mouse to their toy box. Around this time, Neil Gabler finds Roy made a deal with a toy seller named George Borgfeld for Mickey's toys. Their deal specifically excluded dolls. Roy noted the royalty checks from Borgfeld were in longhand like a bunch of farmers and was for a measly $63. He was making over five times that much from selling one doll in one market. Something wasn't right. The sale of a doll to any member of a household is a daily advertisement in that household for our cartoons and keeps them all Mickey Mouse-minded, Roy wrote to Borgfeld. Profits were coming in. They had to be, but they weren't making their way to Disney. Once again, Disney was being middlemanned, cut out of the action like a, well, like a paper doll. Chapter 18. The Lion and the Mouse. Mickey was now a doll, a sewing pattern, a song, and sheet music. He was a comic strip star, too. The decade of work Disney had poured into cartoons was the base of its success, a base that, if Walt could just break out of his gag recycling funk, could support a mighty skyscraper. Maybe the solution was to break one of Mickey's cardinal rules, verism. Walt had insisted that Disney characters stay on the farm, but Mickey was a distinct character in a way Oswald never tried to be. Mickey could bring the spirit of the barnyard with him wherever he went. The Jazz Fool had been the 12th Mickey cartoon, including the overcoated Silence. For Mickey's second season, Walt decided to make some changes. First order of business, no more silent title cards. This was a sound cartoon after all, so Carl whipped up an abridged version of Minnie's Yoo-Hoo. Jungle Rhythm was the first of three planned cartoons that would deliver Mickey to strange new worlds. It feels familiar partly because Walt copied the Gallopin' Gaucho opener of Mickey riding an unusual animal, this time an elephant. His eyes are huge, his tusks small, and he's shaped like a barrel. Ub must have had fun. This beast has size, mass, and incredibly detailed skin that folds and bunches while moving. Walt found a new gag in Mickey swatting at a vulture, missing and hitting a rock. The rock turns out to be a sleeping bear. Mickey climbs a palm tree, but once again, oops, he climbed up the mane of a lion. It's funny the first time, and funnier the second time. This was how to recycle a gag. Turn it into a running joke. The rest of the short is musical animals, but since these are new animals, apes, leopards, and cranes, the gags are new too. For the finale, Mickey pulls a lion's tongue out to play it like a rubber band. The lion disapproves and roars at Mickey. Mickey immediately performs Shave and a Haircut by plucking the lion's four whiskers out and adds the inevitable two bits, part of Shave and a Haircut, by a double honk of its nose. The lion looks defeated, embarrassed, shamed, and impotent. He begins a roar, but it dies on his lips. His mouth starts to quaver as he holds back tears. Not even in Oz was there a more cowardly lion. This all takes place in half a second of footage. Ub's pencil was the best actor in Hollywood. There's irony here beyond Ub being so reticent in person. He also wasn't much for exploring character via actions. He could do it marvelously when instructed, as this shows. But when he had his druthers, Mickey displayed the emotional lability of a toy soldier. That single-mindedness became a key to Mickey's personality. Think about the message of the Mickey shorts. No matter the type of trouble you get into, you can get out of it by being entertaining. Start up some music, make people laugh, and all your problems will vanish. That was Mickey's heart song, the core belief that Walt had spent months trying to decipher. To quote a popular song, "Smile, darn ya, smile." Even Candide would consider this a naive belief. A decade of scars on Walt's and Ub's hides disproved it. Being good enough is not good enough. Timing and luck play huge roles. The lions of real life don't roll over when they're outwitted. They hunt. You don't see them coming until it's too late, and the mice of real life are their lunch. Pat Powers was entitled to a tenth of the money brought in by his sales of Mickey Mouse, and was splitting the Silly Symphony profits with Columbia. But as the distributor, he was the one who received the money to split. And how much he was actually receiving, he kept close to his vest. Powers was a thirsty man, watching a stream of other people's money coming into his office. Keeping more than his fair share was nice, if technically theft. But he wanted it all. He had stolen to get where he was, but he was a man of power now, as his name Powers connoted, and men of power seized what they wanted legally. Powers had no doubt heard about the sad fate of Charlie Mintz. Within 6 months of wheedling Oswald away from Disney, Universal fired Mintz's animation team. A smooth-talking newcomer named Walter Lantz won Oswald from Universal's president, Carl Laemmle, over a game of poker. Lantz lured the great Bill Nolan from New York and made Oswald a good cartoon again. In that story was the secret of how to defeat Walt Disney and how to claim all the Mickey money for himself. At his opportunistic worst, Powers was nothing but a pickpocket when compared with the big boys at the film studios. The studio system was as rigged as a sidewalk game of three-card Monty. Dirty tricks such as block booking and Hollywood accounting assured that the studio kept the lion's share of profits, especially from independent producers. Pat Powers didn't want to fight with Walt Disney over scraps. He wanted the prime cuts. Throughout the 1920s, the big studios battled antitrust lawsuits by the Federal Trade Commission. It would take another decade and a Supreme Court decision to render their anti-competitive actions illegal. They were a problem to indie producers such as Walt Disney, since they were the only avenues to putting a film in front of theater audiences. The only remedy seemed to be to create your own distribution company. And who would ever be crazy enough to attempt that? There was something else to that Charlie Mintz poker story. Desperation. If Walt Disney went bankrupt, Mickey Mouse would be as up for grabs as the Cinephone system had been. Slowly strangling Walt Disney to death with his own purse strings was a 100% legal, or legal enough, way of getting what he wanted. Idealism rather than dollar chasing is the motivating force behind big business in America, Charles Schwab said in 1929. And there was an idealist born every minute. Chapter 19. Dread. The Sound and the Fury, A Farewell to Arms, and Little Caesar all were published in 1929. Virginia Woolf, William Butler Yeats, and Bertolt Brecht all produced new works. The Green Bay Packers won their first of 13 and counting NFL championships. The world gained The Adventures of Tintin, Buck Rogers, and Amos and Andy. For the first time, you could drink a 7-Up, fire a Walther PP, or clean with Pine Sol. Louis Armstrong sang When You're Smiling. Fats Waller tickled the ivories on Ain't Misbehavin' and Honeysuckle Rose, and Arthur Freed was singing in the rain. No one thinks of 1929 for any of that, though. It is solely the year of Black Thursday, October 24th, when stocks fell so precipitously that over $11 billion disappeared from the economy in one day. That was over twice the available U.S. currency in the world. What many forget was that another $14 billion disappeared on the following Monday, then $15 billion more on Tuesday. Earlier that year, the U.S. Treasury had shrunk the size of dollar bills. Now they were seeing the economy itself shrink. Unable to apply brakes any other way, New York's mayor pathetically asked movie theaters to only show uplifting films. The cure to the economy's ills was, apparently, Mickey Mouse films. Mob psychology had borne the bull market to irrational heights, wrote William K. Klingemann, and mob psychology would drag it down. The total month-long market loss was estimated to be, in today's money, almost $7 trillion. Welcome to the Great Depression. Hollywood was slow to realize this. Wall Street lays an egg, Variety said in an insensitive front page headline. East Coast entertainers were ruined. Eddie Cantor owed $285,000 by day's end. Groucho Marx was so distraught from his losses, he couldn't perform on stage with his brothers. Harpo made 3 margin calls in a row, but couldn't meet the 4th. Their whole vaudeville circle had traded stocks and stock tips. Now they were all flat. Playwright George S. Kaufman was philosophical about his fate. Anyone who buys a stock because the Marx brothers recommend it deserves to lose $10,000. At first, the crisis was one for the speculators buying on margin. The wealthy and the workers were safe. But the pain of the magnates was soon shared by the dream companies such as Fox and Universal, not to mention the laborer with a nest egg. Banks failed. Then more banks. No matter where your money was tucked, it was not safe. All that was to come in the 1930s, a firestorm of a decade that would start bleak. Stock prices in 1932 would be 11% of their 1929 high, and end downright apocalyptic. But for all the hurt that people were going through, most could still scrounge up a nickel to go see a show. Ub pointed out that during the Depression, about the only businesses in the country that were doing well were connected to the movies. For now, the people with enough money to go to the movies still went, and they still wanted to see singing and dancing. Walt was happy to oblige. His silly symphony, The Merry Dwarfs, was 6 minutes of little elves, a precursor to Snow White's 7 Little Friends, being jolly to the Anvil Chorus. The Silly Symphonies was getting its own style. If the songs were dark, then you ended up with Hell's Bells or The Skeleton Dance. If they were gentle and sweet, then Springtime. In both cases, music presaged emotion. Directors could join visuals with incredibly specific sounds and music. What audiences felt was what they heard, not what they saw. True horror, for one, was now possible. Walt Disney was no scaremeister, but he saw the elan that Ub had brought to ghoulish endeavors. Sending Mickey into the haunted house, then, was playing to Ub's strengths. The shorts poster of a green-shorted Mickey happily saying, "Hello, folks," gave no inkling of its petrifying contents. As with all great Gothic stories, the haunted house begins on a dark and stormy night. After wind upends Mickey's umbrella, he seeks shelter in the titular house. When he runs inside, the door locks shut behind him. Uh-oh. The next minutes feature spiders, shadows, wraiths, and more bones than the trash can of a Kansas City rib joint. With this, Hell's Bells and the Skeleton Dance, Ub had jumped headfirst into horror, establishing imagery that would later inform everything from haunted hayrides to slasher films. Disney made explicit what had been merely implied by Halloween. Death, horror, and comedy are 2 things that can't be faked, and mixing them began a long and fruitful relationship. Darkness had been Disney-fied. The macabre was no longer off-limits, provided you pulled your dramatic punches. Dread of a different stripe may have been on Ub's mind during production. He had recently been given a Faustian bargain by a mysterious man. The last time he got such an offer, he turned it down. Had he made a mistake? Would the Oswald defection have succeeded if Ub had gone along with them? Was he the secret, not Walt or Mickey? Everything Ub wanted was a signature away, in fact. But at what cost? The mystery man was named Charles Geigerich. He promised Ub his own animation shop and a salary of $300 a week. Geigerich had already set up a distribution deal with MGM. Freedom, money, opportunity, power. This deal had it all. This was how professionals lured you away, by treating you the way you deserve to be treated. There were many problems working with Walt, but at their core was a lack of respect. Walt didn't treat Ub with kindness, deference, or gratitude. He yelled, he bullied, he changed his mind in a heartbeat and blamed Ub for not keeping up. The problem was that Walt was treating Ub like family. It was the Disney disposition in action. Fierce anger one minute, perfect calmness the next. The lack of yelling was the closest to when I'm sorry anyone got. All Ub had to do to leave the toxic environment was leave. Quitting a job because your boss was a jerk was the American dream, but those were the thoughts of an employee with grievances. Ub was a 20% co-owner of Disney. He was management. Who should he complain to about mistreatment? Himself? As co-owner, Ub knew Disney was on shaky financial ground. All the newspaper plaudits in the world couldn't balance out against Pat Powers' calcified checkbooks. Walt and Roy were deferring their salaries. Any day now he could show up and find a closed sign on Hyperion Avenue. He'd be 1/5 owner of a goose egg. But would leaving guarantee that collapse? He wanted to end his relationship with Walt, not end Disney itself. All these questions Ub had, yet he never asked the one that might have made a difference. Who? Who was the force behind Charles Geigerich's offer? Who had the pull to get a cartoon distribution deal? Who had the pockets to launch a new venture yet wasn't already in the mix? Who knew enough about Disney's inner workings to realize that now was the time to see if Steadfast Ub was really upstanding? The man behind the curtain was Pat Powers. That was also why he was behind the curtain. If Ub found out Pat Powers wanted to hire him, the deal would be off. Ub thought he was being recruited by a new competitor, not by Mickey's current distributor. Ub had been loyal for a decade, staying true even when Mintz tried to hire him away. It was Walt who was disloyal, suddenly treating Ub, and everyone else at the company, mind you, like government mules. Animating a mouse was no excuse for behaving like a rat bastard. The friendship was already over. The business partnership had already devolved into resentment. All that was left was to make it official and tell the world that Ub Iwerks was not a whipping boy. Ub's son Dave summed it this way. He'd begun as a partner and was now an employee. But Pat Powers ultimately didn't want Ub Iwerks. Hiring him away was a tactic to weaken Disney. If he was really devious, Powers may have realized that offering Ub a job might start a rift between Ub and Walt, even if Ub turned it down. Animators came and went. The real prize was Mickey Mouse. If Powers could make Disney implode, just as he had with DeForest Phonofilm, he could acquire the mouse in a bankruptcy fire sale. Around this time, according to Ub's wife Mildred, Ub and Walt were out to eat when a young fan approached them. The fan loved Mickey Mouse, so Walt wanted to give him a Mickey sketch. He asked Ub to whip one out. "And I'll sign it," Walt added. Taking credit for Mickey Mouse in front of a child and assuming Ub would be complicit, it was the perfectly calibrated wrong thing to say to the wrong person at the wrong time. Ub's response, "Draw your own goddamn Mickey," may have been the moment that Ub Iwerks and Walt Disney were through. What was worse than losing a friend? Realizing you never had one to begin with. At the end of the day, Ub's labor was more important than his friendship. "You know," Jackson said, "Walt was gentle and nice whenever we were in real trouble. He only got impatient and upset over little things." For all his vision, Walt couldn't see that he was losing one of his best friends. The New York Sunday News interviewed Walt for a December 1929 piece and asked about the mood inside the company. "We just get together, the bunch of us, and work things out. We voice out opinions and sometimes we have good old-fashioned scraps, but in the end things get ironed out, and we have something we're all proud of." Walt Disney was wrong. Chapter 20, Ups and Downs. In December 1929, a dead man walked out on the stage in Paris. That man, Georges Méliès, was a filmmaking pioneer. His inspired uses of the camera helped create the visual effect. His work charmed and dazzled. He was assumed killed in the Great War, but was actually selling toys in a train station. Melius's work was refurbished, and his magical films were shown again to a loving world. Melius had been one of filmdom's biggest names, and his surviving films are still influential today. Yet he was swept under the rug in mere years, vanished from the screen.